check it out now. Huh. No doubt now.
It's the Beating the Book podcast, dead of summer, early July. It's a baseball mid-season podcast. Thought I'd, get off my butt and do a podcast here before football season. This will be two parts. The first part, a interview I did with Mark Borchardt, base winner, on a numbers game at VSiN, where we go over what we used to call our Q2 stats, if you remember our old baseball derivative shows from back in the day on the Beating the Book podcast. It'll be our Q2 review of five inning wagers, best teams, worst teams in the first five lines thus far this season, accumulated units or units hemorrhaged. We'll also do proprietary first inning stats, plus a review of umpires as well. Our typical derivative podcast deal with Mark Borchardt, that'll take place first, only be about 15 minutes. And then after that, Jason Weingarten at Spreadopedia on Twitter, also a Point Spread weekly contributor at VSiN, and Paul Spohr from Fangraphs, the Sleeper in the Bust podcast, and of course his own Twitch channel. We will review our opening season podcast that the three of us did with Matt Vasgersian from ESPN and MLB Network. We'll review some of our ridiculous predictions, some of our good ones, and we'll project forward. It is a mid-season baseball podcast from Beating the Book. Enjoy. For those who listen to the Beating the Book podcast for many, many years, they know that you and I used to do Q1, Q2, Q3 baseball derivative market updates, quarterlies, if you will. So let's do our Q2. We did our Q1 earlier. We'll make this part of the Beating the Book podcast this week as well. I know you're going on vacation, so we'll wrap up the other parts with Jason Weingarten and Paul Spohr reviewing our bets from early in the year. But let's do our thing. Let's go to the easy ones quick. These are widely available. A site like covers.com has these. The most profitable teams in baseball this year. Let's just do it. Just money line, most profitable. The Seattle Mariners. The Seattle Mariners, who you have talked about as like, how in the world are they still in this? They're 45-40. If you had bet the Mariners blindly every single game this year, and by the way, if you're doing that, you're probably doing this wrong. But let's say you have as either a dog or a favorite. You'd be up nearly 19 units, 18.85 units, Mark. San Francisco, no surprise, next, 18.71. Boston, 18.47. No surprise with San Francisco and Boston, but man, there is, well, I mean, I guess there is. There's a surprise with all three of those if we're talking from before the season, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Those teams have exceeded their preseason expectations. People were down on Boston, Seattle, and the Giants. So yeah, it is a surprise, Gil.
Yeah, all three of those north of $18 in your pocket. Fourth place is $10 fewer than that in Tampa Bay. So it's those three teams and everybody else. And when Seattle's 45-40, San Francisco's 53-31, and Boston's 54-32, and nothing was expected of any of them really preseason, that makes all the sense in the world. Now, the biggest hemorrhaging of money by far, what team would that be, Mark? Any guesses, or do you know the answer to this?
Somewhere in Arizona, the Diamondbacks.
Yes. 34.9 units. First of all, this is a bizarro exercise, right? Like, you shouldn't be betting the Diamondbacks every single game, let alone maybe, you know, maybe even one or two, you shouldn't be betting them. But 34.9 units down at the midway point, or just crossing the midway point of the season. I don't know this off the top of my head, but as many years as we've been doing this, that might be the worst number at Q2 that I ever remember. Do you remember anything worse than that?
No, it's pretty low. And you know what's surprising is it's not like they're huge underdogs every night.
Right.
It's like, they're favored today, believe it or not. They're minus 120. So, like, you see these lines, and you're like, well, that's the reason that they've accumulated such a unit loss too, is because they're not like huge underdogs every night.
Yeah, and most of those, no surprise to people, will be on the road. Of course, they had that epic losing streak. They're down over 20 units, almost 21 units on the road. But really, 34.9 units overall if you bet them blindly every single game this year. Second place and third place, not even close. Minnesota would be the next worst, down 18.5 units for blind bettors. Baltimore, 16.5 in the red for blind bettors. Again, how much of this is predictive? How much of this is narrative? That's the point of this exercise. Some of it you might be able to glean something predictive from, but maybe a lot of it's narrative. I don't know. Of all those, would you say Seattle is not something that's predictive? Let's just start there. Like, that will not continue.
I would say that of all those, Seattle's probably the one that I would bet against if I had to go bet blindly against a team. because we talked about my expected standings. You know, they're 45 and 40 on the regular standings, but on the expected standings, they're 38 and 46. So there's about a 7-game difference on what they should be based on their sabermetrics to what they are. So yeah, I would, you know, I'm looking to fade some of these teams at the top three and the bottom three of those expected standings. And that would be one team that I would be looking to fade, Gil.
For sure. Generally speaking, obviously night to night would be, you know, its own little thing, but generally speaking, that would be the case. The other thing that sort of strikes me is this, and I don't remember this from other, you know, halfway points of the season, just how big the drop-off is from some of these top teams in these categories to the next group. We talked about the top three in money line or just in terms of making bettors money, and then it's a huge drop-off after Seattle, San Francisco, and Boston. When we go to run line, the San Francisco Giants are by far the team that has benefited bettors most. If you had bet them on the run line, that's to win if they're a favorite, -1.5 runs, to lose but at +1.5, oftentimes get within that to only lose by one run, you'd be up 20.5 units betting the Giants blindly on the run line, whether as a favorite or dog this year. Second place isn't even close. Like, there's not another team that's even in double digits. I mean, which I don't remember ever seeing a team, maybe I'm wrong, that is that way far out ahead in what is really a sort of de facto power ranking of teams. And then on the bottom side, not quite as big of a difference, but 1 and 2, but still a 7-unit difference between the Twins and everybody else. You'd be down 25.1 units betting them blindly on the run line. So when you talked about the Giants on one end and the Twins on the other, predictive or narrative on both of those?
I think that the Giants is probably more I think there's some predictive to regress. So I think it's more narrative, I guess,
yeah,
with the Giants.
So you think it will regress. Minnesota, do you just think they're bad at baseball, or you think that will get better?
No, I think that they're going to regress too. In fact, they're the second unluckiest team. They're 35 and 48 by the conventional standings, and they should be 42 and 40. So I think that that'll go the other way, Gil.
Okay. Chris Flexen, still the most profitable pitcher. If you had blindly bet Mariners games this year, when Flexen's starting, you'd be up 8.65 units. Savale of Cleveland is second north of 8 units, as is Casey Mize of Detroit. Gilbert of Seattle, also north of 8 units, if you had bet him blindly this year. And then the pitchers that have hemorrhaged the most money, if you had bet them blindly, pardon me, Lopez for Baltimore. The Orioles 4-13 in his starts, almost 8 units in the red. Castillo, Luis Castillo of the Reds, who folks had so much hope for. But the Reds are only 5-12 in his starts. You'd be down 7.8 units with him. And then Dunning for Texas, you'd be down 7.5 units. Texas 4-12 in those starts. So again, you know, Flexen with the Mariners being 11-4 in his starts, like, his numbers don't support that at all, do they?
Yeah, I don't think that he's even league average in his xFIP deal. Let me just pull him up. He's 4.85 base winner ERA. So, I mean, that's just luck. So, between him and the Mariners being lucky, that might be a bet against moving forward.
Yeah, and again, that's the thing with some of these. You really got to glean what helps us with bets and what doesn't. Let's talk about umpires because you do have historical numbers. This might be something we can latch onto. The most reliable over umpires. In other words, when they're behind home plate, their games behind home plate have gone over at the highest rate. Greg Gibson, 6 games this year behind home plate calling balls and strikes. All 6 games have gone over. Shane Livensparger, 5 games behind home plate. All 5 have gone over. I want to give enough sample size. Sean Barber might be the biggest one, though. 14 games behind home plate calling balls and strikes this year. 12 over, only 2 under. And then the others, 6 out of 7, have gone over. Lance Barrett, Carlos Torres, Dan Iasonia, and Edwin Moscoso. Anything historically consistent there?
The one that jumps out is Greg Gibson, and he's about 12th in my over the last. It's a 5-year weighted average. The top 3 that I have an over umpires historically, based on, this is a sabermetric number, Marquez, Wagner, and Mark Carlson. Those are the 3 umpires that their sabermetrics, strikeout percentage, walk percentage, and ground ball would indicate that they are over umpire skill.
Okay, but Greg Gibson, some historical consistency there?
Yeah, he's the one that's closest to the top, Gil. He's about I don't know, 13th or so.
Okay, so when you see Greg Gibson as the listed umpire behind home plate, keep that in mind, that he is not only historically an over-umpire, but is also one here in the first half of 2021. Under-umps, Trip Gibson III, 9 games behind home plate, all 9 under. Chris Guccione, 6 games behind home plate, all 6 under. Lance Barksdale, 5 behind home plate, all 5 under. And then 6 out of 7 to the under, Sam Holbrook and Tom Hallion. Anything there?
Trip Gibson is number 8 in under umpires. So that was the one that kind of stuck out to me. The top 3 sabermetric umpires over the last 5 years, Rehack, Jeremy Rehack, Adam Hamery, and Doug Eddings. But Trip Gibson is he's number 8, Gil.
Those are to the unders you're talking about.
To the under, yeah, to the under.
Doug Eddings is always down there, year after year after year. I'm trying to see where Doug Eddings is offhand right now. Can't find him for this year. But those are interesting numbers. And again, in the case of, in this particular exercise, in the case of Greg Gibson to the over and Trip Gibson to the under, both historically over and under respectively, and also in the first half of this season. That might be something we latch onto. By the way, site like StatFox gives out those umpire listings pretty early. Is there another website that people can go to for that?
Yeah, it's on Twitter. It's called Umpire Crew. That's
Umpire Crew on Twitter.
But you can always know once you get a home plate umpire for one series, they rotate. They go first base to home plate, and then second base to first base, and so it rotates. I guess that would be counterclockwise.
So you can figure it out.
Clockwise,
well,
rather.
Figure it out from that point forward. Okay.
Once you know the home plate umpire for game one, you'll know the home plate umpire for the rest of the series.
All right. Let's go to the first 5. Big shout out to Joe Osborne over there at Odds Shark for putting these together. He updates these pretty frequently. The most profitable first 5 teams. And we can flash up this graphic here, Jason, for bettors. Again, this is a bizarro exercise, Mark, where if you bet these teams every single game of the year, and by the way, these are updated through yesterday morning. So like the Giants had a push through 5 yesterday before poor Kevin Gausman's no hit. He was no hitting the Cardinals through 6. And then I said something on Primetime Action. We said something and then we just completely jinxed it. But the Giants, Astros, and White Sox. Best first 5 teams for bettors if you bet them blindly in a bizarro exercise this year. Giants, you'd be up almost 16 units. Astros, you'd be up over 12 units. White Sox, you'd be up 11.5 units betting those teams first 5. Not the most surprising, although the Giants are, right? I guess if we're going back to the beginning of the season, maybe not to me because I really like the Giants to make the playoffs and I let the hate wash over me when I said that. But I think most people would consider the Giants a shock there. It's the bottom 3 that's always fascinating. D-backs picking up the rear. Okay, 18 units in the red on first 5, too. They're terrible every which way. Pirates down 15-plus units first 5 this year. How about the Tribe? Down 14.26 units, bottom 3. Would that have surprised you?
That is surprising, Gil. If you look at their sabermetric stats, though, in the first 5 innings, they're like, I don't know, 25th in hitting in the first 5. And then they're like, the pitching was really surprising. They're like 23rd in fielding independent in the first 5 innings. So That's a really interesting number. Almost like, hey, you know, wait on the Tribe and then bet them late and live betting. So that is interesting to me, Gil.
Yeah. Again, especially with Savali doing so well, as we just talked about, imagine how bad they must be beyond him in first 5 betting this year. So again, how much of this is predictive and how much of this is narrative? You wouldn't expect the Tribe to continue to be that bad first 5, would you? No.
I don't know. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, Cleveland, their bullpen is so strong. So, you know, I don't know. I think if you bet them, maybe that's the way to bet them is to wait, you know, till the game's in the 4th or 5th inning and then live bet them because of their bullpen.
All right. These are proprietary stats. You'll only get this here on a numbers game at VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. This is first inning pitchers. First inning pitcher performance confined to just the first inning itself. Opponent on base average. I could do batting average. I could do slugging percentage. I'm going to go with on base average for opponents. Minimum 55 plate appearances against. Who do you think the worst? There's no way. I'll give you 100 guesses. You won't come up with this. Worst pitcher in baseball first inning. Brad Keller. a 485 opponent's on-base percentage. Patrick Corbin, 450. Garrett Richards, 448. Dane Dunning, who we've mentioned, 443. Dean Kramer, 439. Shohei Ohtani, by the way, for those wondering, seventh worst first inning pitcher in on base at 435. It should be noted that his batting average against is not that bad. It's just all those walks that he gives up. You know, 227 batting average is pretty good, but a 435 on base, seventh worst first inning pitcher in baseball this year. Carlos Martinez is ninth worst. No surprise there. Nick Pivetta, 10th. By the way, the single best, Mike Minor, 188 on base against. Yu Darvish, 203 against. Walker Buehler, 213 against. Lance Lynn, 214 against. And Max Scherzer, 228 against. Interesting. Anything surprising there on either end?
No, not really. I mean, where does DeGrom, where does he land? Do you have that by any chance?
That is a good question. I'm surprised he's not in there. Let's see here. Maybe it's because it's 55 plate appearances again. What if I lower that? Let me lower that. Let me throw it in the old database here. If I lower to minimum plate appearances against, it's a great question because I can't find DeGrom offhand. I would have thought he would have had 55. Maybe I'm just not seeing his name. Let's see what happens here when I reset. By the way, Trevor Bauer is one of the top 10 best in terms of first inning performance. I don't know if we'll ever see Trevor Bauer again or not, but I can't find DeGrom in all of this.
So, sorry to put you on the spot, Gil. I was just saying, because I know
right.
He's been good in the first.
Oh, here it is. So I lowered, here it is, and there's your answer. So I lowered it from 55 minimum plate appearances against to 45 randomly. He is the single best. So that was the problem. Right. 109 on base against. Oh, my God. He's, like, way better than anybody. I probably went too high on the plate appearances. So DeGrom is the best in every category. A 089 batting average against, a 109 on base against, and a 222 slugging against in the first innings. Ridiculous.
Yeah, he's probably not going to hit that plate appearance threshold because he's going 1-2-3 every time.
Yeah,
out. That's
the problem. That's the problem. No, thank you for asking me that. And then it's Vincent Velasquez, and then it's the guys I mentioned: Mike Minor, Yu Darvish, Dylan Bundy ends up in there as one of the best. When I lower the plate appearances, Walker Buehler, Lance Lynn, Max Scherzer, and so on. So there you go. Jacob DeGrom by far the best. No surprise there. Anyway, that's interesting, folks. Carlos Rodon is a top 20 guy first inning. He's next in the NL. Excuse me. He's second to, I should say, Garrett Cole in the AL Cy Young market. And I don't think Garrett Cole should be anywhere near the top of that, as we've talked about.
And now back at Circa for our mid-season podcast continuation. It's Gil Alexander right here, of course, at the main studio, VEASAN's main studio at Circa, with Paul Spohr from Fangraphs, the Sleeper in the Bus podcast, and his own Twitch channel, twitch.tv/Spohr, where he plays MLB The Show into all hours of the night. I'm still going to get there one night, Paul. One night, I will show up. I look forward to it.
Just come through.
Come through. Come through. I'll be the oldest dude.
You are more than welcome. No. I mean, listen, I actually run a little bit of an older viewer base than most people on Twitch.
Oh, okay.
Just because, believe it or not, I'm more mature, at least relative to the general tenor of Twitch. So you'll fit in. Don't worry. I promise.
I believe it. I do believe that. And Jason Weingarten, at Spreadopedia, Point Spread Weekly writer, and of course, professional baseball better from under a cloud of smoke in Southern Cali. Thank you both. I thought at first what I would do is just go through some of the things. And by the way, Matt Vasgersian could not be here. Quite frankly, did not get back to me. So that's a whole thing. We got to work that out. But Matt was with us on our preseason podcast, and we went through all kinds of things, division by division, what we thought. We went through MVP awards, what we thought there, Cy Youngs. I think we went through home runs as well. And that's where, frankly, I ran out of time, but there's only a few minutes left. So I think that's all we got to. But just to review, let's go through this, and you guys can feel free to react whenever, because in the process, we'll talk about the good predictions and the bad ones. American League East, Red Sox were 23-1 to win the AL East before the season started. None of us talked about them. Vasgersian liked the Jays at their pre-flop value at +520. Jason, you liked the Yankees at -200. Paul, you like the value on both the Jays and the Rays, so we kind of were all over the place in that one. And we'll get your review on all these afterwards, which sort of stick out amongst these. AL Central, I was just laughing almost at the ridiculousness. And this is where it's just so funny to go back and realize how sure you are of certain things. And then here we are, you know, roughly 81 games later. And you're like, oh, yeah. White Sox, there were head-to-heads offered at DraftKings. The White Sox were minus 12.5 games versus the Cubs for the season. Thanks to this recent Cubs swoon, the difference in wins is 8 games right now, with the White Sox having won 50 and the Cubs having won 42. So it's roughly, I don't know, it's 50-35, and the Cubs are 42-44. So what's that, 8.5 games ahead? Here we are just past the halfway point of the season. So, and I just thought that was ridiculous that the White Sox were giving that many games, because Bakota had the White Sox down and the Cubs up. And anyway, joke could be on me. Then I was also laughing at the fact that the Twins were plus 135 versus the White Sox. Oh, that's funny. So that's ridiculous. By the way, the White Sox were 8 or 9 games behind the Twins in Bakota. The White Sox were only minus 112 to win the division. Both of you guys like Kansas City. That was kind of your value play there. How are you feeling about that, guys? Royals at 36-49. Not so hot right now?
I bet on them today.
Did you really?
Not so
what
great.
Did you bet?
Them to win.
To win? What number did you get?
Yeah, their individual game, I think.
130, 133.
Oh, to win today, you mean?
Yeah, I meant like just
yeah. Oh. Against Sonny Gray.
I thought for a second you were like, yeah, I bet them to win the division. Yeah, okay. I was going to say Jason doubling down on the Kansas City Royals. Okay.
Yeah, no, we're done with that.
We're done with that. Yeah. Astros were minus 124 versus the A's in head-to-heads there before the season started. Jason, you were down on both Houston and Oakland. Paul, you disagreed with Jason on both Oakland and Houston. You were like, no, I like both of these teams. You also like the Mariners as a dark horse. Wow, Spore coming up big in the AL Central, AL West here. And Jason, you like the Angels, but that, you know, assumed Mike Trout would be around, so I guess that's kind of unfair. But the Mariners, let me just ask you this. We'll just stop here.
It's not so bad.
No, that's pretty good, man. You were awesome. Mariners are 45-41.
Well, I was going to say.
Go ahead, Paul.
I think we have a little bit of a delay here, Gil. I'm sorry. But I was going to say, Jason, for 500 for the Angels without Trout right now, that's actually not too bad to be where they are right now. They could make a second half surge if Trout comes back and he's himself, and they maybe add a piece or two.
Jason,
not bad, yeah.
Oh, yeah, we do have a serious delay, don't we? Okay. All right. Yeah, not bad at all. And you, Paul, the Mariners at 45-41. Jason and I were talking about this a little on the radio side this morning. You think they are buyers or sellers at the trade deadline?
I think they should find a way to buy on the margins. Obviously, they're not going to get rid of any high-impact prospects. They can buy internally, which is obviously not buying, but like bringing up Kelnick again and seeing where he's at, because nobody really believes that he's a flop. So I think some pieces internally coming up and maybe a fringe piece for the rotation and or bullpen is the way that they should go right now, because they know that they're not fully ready, but they also shouldn't just pack it in and start selling off, you know, aged pieces either. I think that would be a mistake to like sell Haniger and Kendall Graveman for sure.
Yeah. And that would, you know, at some point you don't want to send a message to your fan base like, hey, we're good. Now we're just going to throw away everybody. If they can get somebody young for Haniger, that would be sort of the only justification. NL East, because I want to get through these preseason quick to get your thoughts moving forward. NL East, Matt Vasgersian, who was kind enough to join us again, the preseason podcast, he liked the Braves, but said that if you wanted him to get sexy with the pick, he'd take the Nats. Paul, you love the Nats. And right now, to be honest with you, Nats looking not too shabby, 4.5 back, but a couple games below 500 in the NL East, which is just a total scrum at this point. Jason, you said you don't like anybody. You're just going to bet the NL East games day to day, which probably was good advice. Paul, you did say don't sleep on Trevor Rogers with the Marlins. Just wanted to point that out. And Matt liked the Phillies as a dark horse. But there was no real definitive. The Nats was the most conviction, I think, Paul, you had on anybody there. And then the NL Central, the preseason numbers on the NL Central, the Cardinals were plus 130. The Brewers were plus 275. Your Reds were plus 295. The Cubs were plus 695. And the Pirates were 155-1. Pecota had it, Brewers, Cubs, Cardinals in that order. And the only four teams that had scoring fewer runs than the Cardinals were the Marlins, Pirates, Giants, and Rockies in the NL Central. Fangraphs, your Fangraphs, Paul, where you work, had every team under 500 in the NL Central. And by the way, besides the Brewers, they're not that far off with that. And then the other thing was, and Jason, you had no bets in the NL Central. Dodgers, Padres, everybody was on them in the NL West. Of course, the Dodgers, everybody believed in them to win the World Series, or at least to get there. I did mention that I love the Giants, but that's nothing surprising. And season win totals was not a market we gravitated towards, Jason, you and me. So that was a little different this year. Here's where it gets interesting, I think. American League MVP. Shohei, Jason, you had a 33-1 ticket on Shohei. Do you remember what you said that day?
Not exactly, but I have a fairly good idea of what I said.
You said there's a 50-1 at William Hill. I think I'll go for that. Maybe it was 15-1. I think you said 50-1. But here was your quote. I don't know how much more I want of Shohei. I might get a little more. Unquote. which you have got a lot more of since. And then I went ahead with the whole thing where I was like, hey, if he goes, and I'll tell you the exact numbers I gave. If Shohei goes 12-6 as a pitcher and has a 3.30 ERA, has 22 homers and 77 ribbies, and let's say hits 270, would he be an MVP candidate? And of course, not only is he 4-1 with a 3.49 ERA, although with walk problems, he has 31 homers, 68 ribbies, and 200, and his batting average is 276 already. The only other names we mentioned for AL MVP, Kyle Tucker. Paul, you liked him. You did think Teoscar Hernandez was overvalued everywhere. And then for NL MVP.
Whoops.
Yeah. Well, there's that. You liked, for NL MVP, you did say you liked Trey Turner at 50-1. And the question I asked about Juan Soto is what I now apply to Vladimir Guerrero, which is, I asked during that podcast, I was like, hey, if Juan Soto wins the Triple Crown, do you think he's a lock or do you think someone else might get it? And of course, we could ask that about Vladimir Guerrero now. Anyway, that was the whole thing. And then, Jason, the biggest thing you had going besides Shohei was you had DeGrom at 5-1. You had him, he was plus 375 at the time, but you already had a 5-1 ticket on NL Cy Young, so you were already killing it on that. And then with home runs, Jason, you had Vladimir Guerrero, so you were all over the place, but there was, you know, no mention of Shohei. Anyway, guys, what's the most of all those? Sorry to ramble. What's the thing that's the most hilarious? What are you most proud of? Paul, start with you.
Well, obviously, I'm quite proud of my AL West prowess. Yes. There with the Astros, A's, and even the Mariners as a dark horse. That feels pretty good. You know, nothing stands out to me as, like, I'm not super embarrassed by. I'm still a little bit nervous about the Red Sox and their home run suppression good fortune. I don't know that it can last all year. They're better than I thought, though, so I'm definitely going to take the L on that. I have no problem doing that. But yeah, otherwise, you know, obviously when you make these preseason predictions, you know that everything's not going to be exactly correct. But I don't feel that my processes or any of the three of us were super far off in our processes to the point where we can laugh at each other and poke fun because it's good natured. But I don't think anybody was like way out of bounds in things that they thought fundamentally in terms of determining why they liked certain players or teams.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. And Jason, Ohtani and DeGrom, Vlad Guerrero, you're dead on all those, really.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a nice position to be in halfway through the season, but, you know, I don't like to celebrate futures early because last year Fernando Tatis was the MVP, and then he wasn't.
Fernando Tatis was the MVP, and then he was not. All right, so moving forward then, while that was all fun and games, here we are, you know, just past the midway point of the season. Paul, I'll start with you. If we go to the best sort of division plays out there, and I know, and I'll cite odds to you as you request them. But right now, as you look at all these divisions and you think to yourself, what's the team that you can see either being a buyer at the trade deadline or that they've underperformed and you think they've got an outside shot to win the division? Where might a bet be?
How many people are tired of me talking about the Reds? Raise your hand.
I am not.
It's probably everybody, and I understand because I never shut up about them, but I'm still on this ball club because they have not given me any reasons to not be. They're 44-40. They are a good bit behind the Brewers after the Brewers' big surge, and I do still like that Brewers club. So it's going to be tough, but it's not impossible. They should be buying. Now, they cried poor, and they discussed maybe trading Castillo and Gray this past offseason, which thankfully they didn't do. That would have been a slap in the face to their fans. But I think they should go out and buy as well, buy on the margins. Yeah, they don't have to go and get the biggest pieces out there, but my God, do they need bullpen. If they're not talking, I know it's hard to do intra-division, but if they're not talking to the Cubs about Kimbrel and the Pirates about Rich Rod, then they're idiots. I mean, even Ian Kennedy, I know he has home run issues, so going to Cincy wouldn't be great, but anything would be better than what they have. So they need like two or three bullpen pieces. Tony Santillan's going to come up and be in that bullpen. That will help. Castillo has found his form again, which is basically an addition in and of itself because of how bad he was. I still really like this Reds team. They're in second place. I doubt there's great odds on any of the first place teams. So the Reds are still where I would focus most right now if I were coming in making a fresh bet for the second half.
And they're 10-1 to win the NL Central. They're 6.5 games back. And according to the good folks at Tankathon, which I usually use for the NBA, but they also do baseball stuff as it turns out, they have the Reds with the fifth easiest schedule the rest of the way based on opponents' win percentages. So that kind of lines up kind of nicely. Jason, same question.
Well, first, I also like the Reds, and Paul is dead on. They need bullpen pieces. I was watching the game last night, and I was very frustrated with how they were pitching out of the bullpen. That's a good bet. I saw as high as 12-1 today. You know that my pick for a division bet right now would be the Nationals at 6-1. I saw 7-1 at DraftKings earlier when I was looking around. One of the main things, the reasons I like the Nationals is that they have a stretch in the second half, or the Mets actually have a stretch in the second half where they have 25 games with 13 of those home and away versus the Dodgers and Giants and the Nats on both sides of that. And I think it's a very good 3-week stretch for the Mets to make up any of their remaining games on the Mets by then.
Yeah, Nationals 7-1 at DraftKings. All these are DraftKings, by the way, to win the NL East. They're 4.5 back. Phillies are between the Mets and the Nationals, just as, the Reds are actually second to the Brewers, so not just as the Reds were in the previous conversation, but the Nats 4.5 back with the Phillies in between them and the Mets, 7-1. And according to Tankathon, Washington, middle of the road in terms of the schedule. But as you were saying, Jason, and I'll get the actual numbers per our conversation, but Nationals, really easy schedule. Mets, kind of difficult as well. So that plays out nicely for them. Nationals sort of easy on the front end after the All-Star break and really easy down the stretch, the middle area here in the second half of the season. That will test their mettle. But other than that, they're bookended by pretty easy stretches. Always tough to do the schedule game, but it does give, as the schedule lessens, it does give some sort of sense of what remains in front of these teams. You like that Nats. You were always in the tank. We just mentioned before the season started, you loved the Nats then. Would you play that too, Paul, at 7-1?
Yes, I would. I definitely think this is a team that's shown that they'll be aggressive, and losing Schwarber obviously really hurts, but I think that they're going to go out and make a move. It could be a very high impact move. You know, rentals don't cost what they used to anymore, so they can find a key rental out there for that offense, maybe a little bullpen for them as well, and go get it. In fact, they love trading with the Pirates, so don't be surprised if maybe Rich Rod ends up there. Now, I know it's a new regime there, but I'm sure there's still some links between the Nats and Pirates front offices that maybe they get that deal going. But they could use a big piece as well, and Rich Rod would be a great right-handed complement to Brad Hand, who's pitching remarkably well this year too. So I'm still in on the Nats right there with Jason.
All right, and I didn't get a chance to ask you this, Paul, but Yankees, they don't really have selling at the trade deadline in their DNA. Would you make any bets on the Yankees beyond, forget the AL East for a second, but as far as a pennant, as far as a World Series, or do you consider the Yankees to be a fine baseball club, but they're just not a World Series team this year?
I tend to lean toward the latter there. Fine baseball club, better than one game over 500, but not necessarily a contender this year, because I think getting into the playoffs is going to be very difficult for them. We already know how tough their division is, and no matter what I say about the Red Sox, the more they keep winning, the banked wins that they have, they're going to be tough to catch. So now that there's three teams between them and the division for the Yankees, what moves can they really make to completely fortify and turn this around? I'm reluctant to completely bury them, but yeah, I think they're going to end up, even if they get a wild card, I wouldn't necessarily see them going all the way this year. The pitching just isn't there. Put aside Cole's troubles, because I don't really think that they're much more than a blip right now. And I know they kind of coincide with the spider tack, but I don't think he's made off that. Who else do they have? Who do you trust there? And then they have the weird version of the bridge to the closer is good, but the closer is bad. It's usually the other way around. So they might consider maybe moving a couple pieces without burying or anything. They're not going to sell, but I could see them actually moving a piece or two and kind of set themselves up in a better position for 2021 or 2022. Excuse me.
I asked Jason these questions on the radio side. I've asked this of both of you on the radio side. So for the podcast audience, Jacob DeGrom, we talked about this a little this morning. Obviously the Cy Young favorite by a mile in the National League. But MVP, he's right around even money, plus 115 in some spots. So he's the short shot. And Jason, you were saying today that not only, of course, is he a starting pitcher, who obviously only shows up every 5 days or so, but he doesn't really log a lot of innings ultimately this year with a lot of, you know, with a few of his starts sort of being abridged, if you will. And you don't think he should be the MVP front runner in the NL?
I don't think 160 innings or 170 innings is enough to win a pitcher the MVP over, say, Fernando Tatis or Ronald Acuna, who are having incredibly good seasons, you know, to say nothing about Nick Castellanos, who I actually want to win. No, I don't think DeGrom should be even money. I just don't. Like, 160 innings isn't enough. That would be the lowest amount any Cy Young pitched who's not a reliever. So, you know, I think he's a lock for the Cy Young if he stays healthy, but no chance at MVP for me.
Wow. See, this is so hard because we're handicapping humans with awards, and I just keep thinking to myself, even that outing the other day when he gave up 3 earned runs, Paul, in the first inning, he ended up with 7 innings, only those 3 earned runs given up, 14 Ks and no walks, and you're like, oh, that's the worst DeGrom we're ever going to see. And even if it is 160, let's say 160 innings, if his ERA is like 0.7 whatever and all his other stats are just sick, but a guy like Tatis or Acuna hits, I don't know, 50 homers with 130 RBI, I just wonder what voters will do with that. And I understand Jason's point, I'm not as sure as he is. I think I still might vote for DeGrom. I don't have a vote. I'm not sure where you come down on that.
Yeah, I understand what Jason's saying with regards to the innings, if he is more at like 175 or something. But if you look, you know, you can make the case like batters faced versus plate appearances, right? In terms of impacting the games that they're in. I know they go once every fifth day, but he impacts the game in such a significant way when he does play that when you start to do that math there, it kind of checks out a little bit more. Plus, you have the fact with somebody like DeGrom that he adds a little bit to the hitting. And this year it's been a lot of bit, but I'm not necessarily thinking that he's going to hold an 806 OPS. But that's a little extra juice on the side. I will say, though, with the way Tatis and Acuna are trending, I think they're darn near like 40-20 type seasons with good batting averages on contending teams. I think in the end, it'll probably still go to a hitter, especially if he comes short of that 200-inning mark, which he's almost certain to do, DeGrom is. I just don't know that voters are going to want to vote an MVP pitcher that doesn't have that giant workload, because not every guy and gal makes the link of batters faced versus plate appearances to show that it's actually pretty close, because he has 300 batters faced right now, and Tatis has 293 plate appearances. So they're not too far off in terms of that. Now, there's also defensive chances for Tatis, but there's also the plate appearances for DeGrom. So the math ends up working pretty close, But I agree, it's probably unlikely if Tatis or Cunha or Turner or Castellanos or some other guy emerges with just a devastatingly good season offensively.
Right. But if it's not DeGrom, it's not like either of you are racing to bet a specific player for NL MVP at this point, are you?
Correct.
I've picked off a couple numbers in the last month or so. Max Muncy, 200-1 was one of the better ones I liked. Castellanos I had early, so I haven't added much more. I added a little bit because he was like 33-1. But I mean, it's just like Paul said, you look at Tatis and Acuna, and it's just really hard to want to bet against them. Just not there's not good odds on them, so I'm just kind of chilling. And you know, we missed on Seager early and had a bunch on that.
Yeah,
but I think the key was, is that we were looking for the number two hitter in the Dodgers lineup, who was going to be Seager, and now I doubled down on that with Max Muncy.
That makes sense. I got beat with so many injuries in my preseason award, like Seager and Soto. Like, my whole thing is riddled. Cabrian Hayes, right? Like, every rookie of the year.
That's brutal.
Everything just got destroyed, pretty much.
Hayes can still win.
He can still win.
Soto, I think Soto can still win. I think I saw some like 60-1, and his advanced stats all basically are like, you know, the same as Fernando Tatis, his hard hits and everything, his barrels. He's the best player in baseball. It's not Mike Trout still.
He is, but you know, I had him, Paul and I actually have him together for most hits at 75-1. And when you lose all those games on those counting stats, it's just so hard to make up that stuff. So again, betting him sort of in the wrong market, maybe, or maybe it's just not going to work out for him in any market. The other thing is, okay, so the AL, because obviously NL Cy Young, it's DeGrom's, period. I don't know what would have to, if DeGrom never pitched another pitch the rest of the year, I think he's still the NL Cy Young award winner. In the AL, though, it's a little different. So we'll get to MVP in a second. But AL Cy Young, we've all talked about this on the radio side, but Gerrit Cole, obviously, one of the biggest victims of spin rate. That was the other funny thing about listening back to our podcast with Vasgersian, is we were like, oh, there's five ballparks with humidors, and we don't even know what they are. And then we had no idea there was going to be, like, you know, such a muted run environment. Now, all of a sudden, a crackdown on grip with pitchers. And who knows if it's that or if it's, you know, the weather, the climate changing, obviously, at this time of the summer, that's creating a better run environment. But obviously, Cole is the biggest culprit, along with the Trevor Bowers of the world, who has all kinds of other problems now, obviously. His performance, Cole's, has dropped off a cliff, and you wonder if he'll get it together a little bit to be, you know, to improve from what how it's going right now. But there is doubt as to whether or not he'll ever get back to elite this year, because obviously he was one of the biggest people that was concerned about this crackdown. He was very public about it. He is still the favorite to win the AL Cy Young. I don't think he should be, based on what we've seen. Like, I think that's a terrible bet right now. Do you agree with that? And if it's not Cole, who's the guy? Because my conclusion is, it isn't the most sexy thing to say, but like, I think Carlos Rodon has the most awesome advanced stats and the most sustainable numbers, and he's like plus 325. Paul, let's start with you. Do you think Cole should be the favorite? And if not Cole, then who?
No, Cole should not be the favorite, and I agree that it should be Rodon. You know, I think there's a strong case for the White Sox to just kind of keep going with him. Yes, he has a lot of injury history that is not very good, but, you know, I hate to be callous about it, but they only have him on a one-year deal, and this is their window to win. They've got to go. I don't think they can let up with him. Obviously, they might spread him out a little bit, skip a start, one or two here and there, but that shouldn't cost him the potential at the Cy Young. I think this is a great dream season for Rodon, and if he stays healthy, he's absolutely got to have a great shot right now. I know Eovaldi's having a great year, and I've been a long time Eovaldi guy. Gil, I think you and I probably talked about Eovaldi back on the Dodgers, and I was probably pumping him up. But I don't fully believe in everything he's doing this year with the home run suppression, because he doesn't have a lot of Ks. It's a lot of control more so than command. I'm just a little nervous about him. So I'd love to pivot to Eovaldi there. I might if the number was right, but I'm with you on Rodon. If Cole fell to a good enough number, I'd be interested, but I doubt he is. I haven't seen any markets that jump out to me. me, maybe another bad start would get him there, and then I could jump. But as it stands right now, Cole is still overpriced. Rodon, maybe Eovaldi on a hunch. And then otherwise, you're looking for a dark horse somewhere.
Yeah, and Rodon, like, I know some people are listening to this and like, plus 325, that doesn't sound that great. But like, think about Jason having DeGrom at 5-1 in his pocket, or plus 450 or whatever he had. All those DeGrom tickets, that seems pretty darn good right about now. So like plus 325 in the worst thing in the world. And it's funny because Rodon was a guy who, when he first came up, I probably lost the first five or six times I ever bet on that guy because he had such a walk problem. And I was like, he's great.
For sure.
I'm going for it. And I would lose every time. But he's killed those walks. It's no longer a problem. Jason, if not Gerrit Cole, then who?
I bet Zach Greinke at 80-1 about a week ago. I'm not super confident in him, but I do think he's going to be a 200 inning guy. And I only saw like six or eight pitchers in the AL that are going to most likely reach the 200 inning mark. I bet Chris Bassett yesterday at 65-1, and he proceeded to have his worst start of the season.
I love when that happens. Yeah.
So, I got the tail end of that. It was as high as 100 and 200-1 a couple weeks ago. I'm thinking he might be a down ballot guy, but Lance Lynn, Rodon, and Liam Hendricks, I guess, would have an outside case if you were including relievers. I just don't think they have good odds. Rodon and Lynn in particular, under 10-1, I wouldn't really touch either. It's a tough market. It's probably my least favorite market of the year still. Even, I said before the season I didn't want to bet anything, and I bet a couple things, and it's still kind of not very exciting to me. Kyle Gibson, that was the other one. I tried to bet Kyle Gibson at 70-1. He's having an incredible year. He's just unfortunately on a bad team. I can't see him win. And he also might get traded to an NL team in a couple weeks.
Last thing before we get to that, because I do want to ask about the trade deadline.
They should trade him.
The last thing is MVP. So Otani versus Vlad. It's a two-man race. And we've already talked about like what, it's like the LaMelo Ball thing. How many games would Otani, or how deep into the season would he have to go where it was enough for him to be the MVP? Jason, you said 120 games. And it's come up, Paul, if he has a few more, two or three more bad starting pitching performances, like the 41 pitch effort the other day where he only went 2/3 of an inning, where the walks came back in the first inning. Do you think that could hamper his MVP candidacy? Because the reason he's the favorite is not only because he has 31 homers and is great from, as a hitter, but it's because he's like Babe Ruth, right? He's Ruthian. And Bill Simmons had this great comment. Jason Kahn, my producer, was telling me about at his latest podcast, where he's like, if this were the 80s, like where baseball was bigger than it is now, we would not stop talking about what Shohei Ohtani is doing. But since it's now, and there's every, baseball is not what it was, and because he plays for the Angels, quite frankly, it's like the Angels are missing this opportunity. Like they're wasting this on the Los Angeles Angels, right? Because they are just who they are and can't seem to coalesce. And obviously they have the injury to Trout too. But if he has a couple more of these, a few more of these, do you think that hurts his MVP candidacy? Like, wouldn't that follow?
Yeah, I mean, if he has a few more like that, by the way, this is not the same thing because it did not hurt me financially the way it did with, or potentially with Bassett for Jason. But literally the day before he had that brutal outing in New York, I was like just slam dunking all over trolls on Twitter about how much better he is than Vlad as a candidate for the MVP because he has all this pitching and you're not giving enough credit to the pitching. And then he goes out and gives up seven earned and my mentions were a mess because people were rightly clowning me back. But, a couple more like that, yes. But that's such an anomaly of an outing that I don't think that I'm too worried that he's going to have a couple more starts to that degree of failure. I do worry that the walks can return at any moment. The splitter is a feel pitch. We saw this with Kevin Gausman for years that where it went in and out. But I do have it on good authority via some folks that work in the KBO and have been in the KBO, that Asian pitchers in general do not generally doctor the ball much. So this change of not being able to use stuff is not something that's inherently going to affect somebody like Ohtani necessarily as much as it might his American counterparts. So I don't think that that had anything to do with the bad inning in Yankee Stadium or anything like that. I think any issues that he has are of his own volition and the struggles that he has with the splitter. If he can avoid any more of those that bad of starts, and as long as his ERA is, I'd say, 4.20 and under, then everyone will see it as a positive. Once you start getting into the mid fours, people will start to, wrongly, by the way, say that that's a negative. Even if he's a 4.50 pitcher, that's still very positive, but people will perceive it differently. As long as he's under four, I think he's a lock for the MVP. If it starts to meander toward 4.20, then the questions come in, especially if Vlad wins the Triple Crown. Even though the Triple Crown, I'm not that impressed by it. Like, they're overlapping stats. That doesn't mean as much to me as if you won the Triple Crown of average OBP and slug, which he also might do, by the way. Vlad is a god, and he absolutely deserves to be in this conversation. But for me, it's Ohtani easily right now.
Yeah, and I think that's like, we touched on this in the preseason podcast too, because you were very articulate about it, which is, you know, for 45 years between 1967 and the year 2012, Carl Yastrzemski won it in 1967, home runs, RBIs, average, triple crown. And it was this thing for 45 years, was like, nobody can do it again. Nobody can do it again. And so when Miguel Cabrera did it in 2012, and it was like the Trout versus Cabrera thing, there was sentiment among voters, well, triple crown, we've been talking about this for 45 years, we got to give this to Cabrera. And that may have been right or wrong, but I think you're right. I think we are sophisticated enough to know now that those baseball card stats, what we deemed as the, you know, the Holy Trinity, the triple crown, it just doesn't mean as much anymore now that that is sort of out of the way.
Yeah.
And so if Vlad wins it, the notion, if we went back in time and said to somebody, you know, in 1985, hey, someone's going to win the Triple Crown and not going to win the MVP, it would, like, our heads would explode. But now it's like, yeah, no, he shouldn't, because this guy's doing what Babe Ruth was doing. I mean, it's even more unbelievable. And so I guess there's two questions. So one, it's a statement, is one, anybody who has the notion to bet Vlad, you're just betting against a Shohei injury, I think, at this point. Would you, Jason, I know you have a 33-1 on Shohei. I have a 4-1, and I'm thrilled with it, right? Would you, if somebody came to you right now and said, hey, so should I bet Shohei at this number, head-to-head against Vlad, basically? Would you tell them no?
I mean, I wouldn't encourage laying, you know, minus 160 or whatever it is, whatever the best number you can get, you're going to be laying a price, so... No, I wouldn't encourage it at this point. I think maybe you would get more value if you had access to the Westgate and you could bet Ohtani to hit the most home runs. It's still like 2-1 or 3-1. But no, I wouldn't bet him at MVP at this point. I'm not sure I would bet Vlad either at the market price. I would consider betting Vlad just as insurance if I could get like 4-1 or 5-1, but Not at the market price. The thing is, at this point, you really just gotta sit and watch the second half, and, you know, kind of just hold your position.
By the way, how rampant are those home run markets? Only the Westgate has them. Does anybody else put them up still?
Will Hill has them, but I don't think I have access to them, so I never pay attention.
Yeah.
I always check Westgate because they tend to update their numbers daily.
Shohei with 31, Vlad with 28 as we do this here just before, 5 days before the All-Star break. And then there's, you know, then there's all the usual suspects behind, though, right? Tatis and Acuna. I feel like, I was saying this to you this morning, I feel like Acuna really hasn't gone full throttle Acuna yet. Like, we're still about to get that, I think, at some point. And then there's our guy, Adolis Garcia, which we have at 100-1. We're saying he's 10 behind all of a sudden with just 21 homers. For a second there, we were co-leaders at 16. That's how unbelievable it's been with Ohtani and the rest of those guys just hitting balls. Guerrero, obviously, too, hitting balls out of the park. All right, so last thing then, guys, as we sit here, trade deadline looms at the end of July, so it's 24 days away. We talked about division plays. Is there any team that we didn't mention, Paul, that someone out there is thinking to themselves, well, I don't know, maybe it's the Blue Jays, maybe it is the Giants who lead in the NL West and might make moves themselves, have the best record in baseball, at least still at this very moment. Is there a team we haven't mentioned that you're thinking to yourself, they might be a sneaky pennant future or even a World Series future. Not saying that they'll actually win those respective things, but that you'll have enough equity in the number where you could actually play with it once the playoffs get there, assuming they get there.
How about Oakland? You got to secure a wild card or thwart the Astros. I don't think they will, but they're only four games out, so it wouldn't be insane to see them do that. I think they're poised here nicely. They've kind of had a quiet first half. Nobody's really talking about them. Bassett's having his breakout, as Jason highlighted. Sean Manaea might be another under-the-radar AL Cy Young candidate, by the way. He's killing it. Now, he has some health issues, too. They're going to need to keep him healthy. James Kaprielian's a hot rookie. Longtime prospect finally panning out for them on the heels of that Sonny Gray trade years ago. And they're not afraid to make moves, and sometimes high impact moves. I still think that Trevor Story fits there very well. As a rental, he will not cost them an arm and a leg. They can move something of substance over to Colorado, but it does not have to decimate the Oakland system. Elvis Andrus is not pushing him out in any way, shape, or form. He gets in that lineup, all of a sudden you got that big bat coming in. If Chapman can get himself going, they've got the pieces, whether it's lineup, defense, starting pitching, and bullpen. I still like Oakland as a sneak tip. And then, like you said, as long as they get in, then you can kind of play with that number if you've got them for a pennant or a World Series. So yeah. Oakland's my pick on that.
Trevor Story, maybe the biggest name in free agency at the trade deadline. Twins have a couple of players, Cruz and Berríos. It's all kinds of players that would just look awesome in another uniform. Jason, same question. Is there someone who might have some futures equity in the postseason that we haven't mentioned? Paul went with the A's.
I think the Phillies would be the other team to take a look at. Not necessarily a division future, but a pennant future. I tend to look at AL, NL pennant futures instead of World Series because I'd rather, win my money on that second to last leg as opposed to waiting to the final leg and losing or something. So I do a lot of that. I would probably look at the Phillies. They have Wheeler and Nola up top, and I look at teams. Typically, I'm saying, well, who could beat the Dodgers? How can they beat the Dodgers? And you look at the Phillies, they have Realmuto, Harper, top tier players, real, good guys, MVP caliber, whatever you want to call them. They have Zach Wheeler, who's probably the second best pitcher in baseball, or second best pitcher in the NL, at least. And Aaron Nola, also a good guy. And sometimes Dodgers' bats just go cold, like you saw it versus the Marlins this week. They lost back-to-back one-run games. you could just, go in there with Wheeler and Nola and upset the Dodgers. I don't think it's a huge possibility, but it's definitely a possibility that the Phillies have a good second half and make the playoffs. I'd probably look at them if I wasn't already on the Nats.
Yeah, how good is Wheeler, by the way? If it weren't for DeGrom, we would be talking about Wheeler all the time. But DeGrom is just so off the charts. Mm-hmm. That thing you mentioned also about going for the pennant rather than the World Series, didn't we talk about that, Jason, like with the Mattress Mac guys who were helping him out and Anthony Curtis and his buddy Frank, they know what they're doing in terms of hedging and stuff. But wasn't that like our criticism of it? We're like, why didn't they have Mattress Mac winning the pennant rather than the World Series? Do you remember having that conversation, or am I imagining that?
No, we definitely had that conversation because I've talked about that before. Like, I had it with the Bucks last year in the NFL. I had them to win the NFC and not the Super Bowl. You just sometimes you could do both. As well, you don't have to stick to one, but I just prefer to. I call it front legging it, but I just prefer to do the pennant future.
All right, guys. Then in the end, we still think same. The one thing that we still stick by that we had before the season, we still think the Dodgers, unless again anything can happen in a postseason series, but we still think the Dodgers are the leader in the clubhouse, even despite perhaps not having Trevor Bauer to win it all. And if so, who do they play in the World Series, Paul?
Yes, they are, and I'm sorry to go boring, but Houston is a I still love that club.
I think so too.
And they could also add if they have supplemental pieces. So yeah, I know it's a little boring for folks because we've seen it and they've been kind of the leaders over the last few years, but that's my World Series. I'm not going to make it too complicated.
I agree with you completely. I think that's almost clearer than anything. Jason, what about you?
If I say Dodgers, Houston, it's going to be like one of those morning shows where all the hosts agree.
That's right. They have the logos
wrong.
The same. Yeah.
So I have to contractually give a different answer. I do think it's the Dodgers, but I think it might be the White Sox with their rotation. I think they can come out of the AL and play for a pennant this year.
Yeah. Well, stranger things have happened.
The only reason I didn't say them is because they lose a superstar every other day. Now, they might start to get some of them back. Robert and Eloy are cleared for baseball activities. So I'm not too far off on that. I'm not just trying to snake in on what Jason's saying. But I almost said them, except I looked at their IL, and it was longer than their roster. So that was my only concern with them. They just lost Grandal for a long period of time. But they, too, should be aggressive, and I could see them making moves. The Eduardo Escobar rumors have started early. They should already have him on the team, to be quite honest. Keep an eye on this Gavin Sheets guy who just came up, Larry Sheets' kid. I really like him. So, yeah, I will not rule out the White Sox. I do want to see White Sox-Houston in the ALCS because I think that'd be an excellent series.
Larry Sheets' kid. That just made me feel old right there. All right, guys. Appreciate it. Paul Spohr, again, Fangraphs, Sleeper in the Bus podcast, and, of course, twitch.tv/Spohr, where he plays MLB The Show. And has a whole bunch of people in there on a seemingly nightly basis. How many times in a week are you in there?
Usually 5 to 6.
Five to six.
Sometimes 7. It just depends.
Very nice. And then Jason Weingarten, who you can find on Twitter at Spreadopedia. By the way, it's Paul at Spohr, Sporer. Jason is at Spreadopedia. Point Spread Weekly writer, pardon me. Always on a numbers game, as Paul is. Always, we try to get them both on primetime action as well. And Jason, you may have a podcast coming. People should know about this.
Yep, that's the plan. Just waiting on the final details, but it should be a daily 10-15 minute show on VSiN every day.
That's
for 5 days a week.
That will
Let's
be
go.
Awesome. Ruminations from Jason, not only on baseball though. You'll go into other sports as well.
Yeah, all sorts of stuff. We'll talk about, you know, different markets and different things I'm doing and what's available and how to bet it and how to be a better better.
How to be a better better. I love it. Paul, Jason, thank you both, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Beating the
Gentlemen,
Book podcast, mid-season on baseball. Next time you'll hear from us probably will be right before the NFL season, maybe a little college football, I don't know, where we'll do guessing lines and the Megapod with Mike Palm and Todd Wishnev all over again live here from Circa. Actually, maybe over at the D. We look forward to that. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. Good luck with all your bets.